I'd like to hear about your final bill that you had as a congressman regarding Syrian refugee children.
That would be H.R. 6510, I believe. Yeah, I was asked by a professor, well, a professor from, I think it was Georgetown, was looking for a sponsor to author a bill to offer sanctuary for youngsters, orphans between, I guess, age between 3 and 10 or 3 and 13, or by parents who are willing to have their children come here to be held here for security's sake, because a lot of the what we call collateral damage in wartime are children and orphans. And so I immediately said I'd be willing to do that, basically because I knew what happened to orphans in the Civil War in El Salvador, and they ended up not being taken care of. And
You served there for a while, right?
Yeah, I was in Peace Corps there in 65. Yeah. So the and it was a last minute thing, and I think the objective was to put something down, put a marker down for this session, and ask members of Congress to pick it up this new session, the 115th session, to move that forward. Youngsters who are infants or do not pose a security problem, that a lot of the folks who are naysayers, get in the way of allowing refugees to come to this country. I think that that's just one strategy that we'll be able to make the youngsters safe in a place where we're willing to take care of them for the duration of the Civil War out there.
Is that a bill you think has a chance of becoming law under this administration and this Congress?
I'm not going to say no, even in spite of the fact that, the president has a reputation of, shooting from the hips. I think that we have to try and see if that is something that he can be convinced of asking for it and also signing it. Finding a sponsor, I don't think will be a problem. Having to get through the House, I think it will be a chore. But I think if we emphasize the fact that we want to have a place that's safe for these orphans and youngsters, that it should touch the compassion of our members, and we should be able to move that forward.
So Donald Trump ran on a platform that included a lot of discussion about how he seemed very wary of Muslim populations. He was talked at part about a Muslim registry. He has since started to put things into action that are more restrictive of immigration. What do you think of the changes in immigration policies and these perspectives that a lot of American people responded to?
Well, I responded the opposite way. But he has put out some executive orders o over the past couple of days, initiating some moves towards supposedly building a wall between Mexico and ourselves, indicating that he's going to get cooperation from Mexico. But, the president has this ability to stretch the truth or put some information out there that may not be completely true. I think the others is he's not discouraging anybody from coming up with bills to limit the flow of immigrants and refugees into this country, both of which I think are contrary to our character and to the kinds of values that we stand for in this country historically.
Why do you think now there has been a president elected who has run on this kind of value system when we just had, for example, a president who I think was maybe much more global in vision?
Well, my sense is that the president has felt the temperature and the pulse of the country, where we have missed, we just really have missed the boat in terms of the sentiment that some of these people had. We heard what they were saying, but we didn't understand fully the sentiment that they had, that they were willing to act on it. We thought we were, I think the Democrats thought they were addressing the issues that people cared about, but I think that we somehow missed that boat, and he touched that nerve, was able to make that work for him.
Do you think that there is validity then in the things that he is putting into effect and that has resonated with Americans?
No, I think that those are issues I think those are the issues that sort of instigated some anger and some sentiment that people started feeling like, oh, there's someone that's thinking along the lines that we're thinking. I don't think that a lot of these things that he has said, a lot of them would not impose, I think, if they sat down and really thought about it. But we did miss the boat, I think, and we have to be able to be a little bit more thoughtful in how we come up with solutions and how we talk to people. The president did not win the popular vote. And I think the popular vote was in excess. It was probably the highest popular vote that any presidential candidate has ever had. You know, a little over 3.5 million people voted for Hillary. But Trump had won the electoral votes.
For a lot of people, I think that part of the surprise of Donald Trump coming into office with policies that seem almost from a different era to some extent is that there's been an evolution of thought for a lot of people, both regarding different nations through our awareness and the media age of identity enlightenment, the people of different gender identities. You yourself have a transgender daughter. You yourself have a transgender granddaughter.
Sure, yeah.
Yet I've heard people say that things maybe have been moving too fast, and with globalization, with obviously as a jobs issue that Trump's brought up, comprehension of, you know, things that are, say, not binary gender-wise or multicultural, which people might not be as used to, that there's been a backlash of some sort. So I'm really curious from your perspective as a 75-year-old man who has seen quite a lot in many different venues that a lot of us and I will never experience and have never experienced, what do you think of evolution of thought of people in the United States and where we're at?
Yeah, I think your initial comment about drawing things from the past in the president's rhetoric during his campaign is probably accurate. I mean, there's everything that he's talked about is really contrary to the kinds of things that those of us who believe in American values, family values, the progress that we made in civil rights, the progress that we made in LGBT rights, and the quick change in attitude towards LGBT in the last 8 years during Obama's administration, from the man on the street to Supreme Court, has changed drastically, and policies have changed. So those things happen quite rapidly. I don't think that the speed of the change that has happened over the last 8-10 years or the last 75 years that I've been alive has been rapid in the sense that we're not able to absorb it. We absorbed the last 10-15 years the massive changes that's gone on in our social political lives. I think it's the way we have not been bringing people along and sharing that information, sharing our experiences with the other parts of this country. I'm sure that if we did it properly and brought them along consciously, rather than assuming that everybody has the same sentiment as we move along, as we change, I think that we were in error on that, and I think that we need to take time and effort to bring them along. It's like teaching a classroom. You know, some teachers teach at the top of the class, some teach to the middle, but no one ever teaches to the slowest part of the classroom. Those are the ones that we sort of should be paying attention to and bring them along and help them understand the changes or the concepts that are going on in this country. A lot of them have left behind, and I think that that's something that we need to do. Myself, in the last 16 years since I've been in Congress, I've had to really do more reading, asking more questions about Islam. Didn't even know what the word in the term Taliban meant when 9/11 first happened. So it was kind of bewildering, I think, and those who never paid attention or didn't bother to study and understand that part of the world that's always been there since biblical times, we never have been taught, teaching ourselves, nor have our institutions been teaching us, keeping us up to date on the things that are going on in other parts of the world. We've been very self-centered, if you will, or European-centered. And now the last 15 years, we've been very Asia-centered, but we messed with the Middle East and Southeast Asia, but we never took the time to study it. And if we did, we'd find out there's a lot of parallels in our religion, in our history, and there's a lot of activities that went on in this country pre-slavery when it deals with Muslims and Islam. We just didn't take the time to study.
That's Mike Honda. He's a longtime former congressman representing California's 17th congressional district. So if you were in office right now, how would you deal with having a president who's radically different from any president we've had recently?
First, I would probably build a good, strong, dependable coalition among my own peers and make sure that we have ways of rapidly responding to what comes out of the White House, as we have done in the past when we had our own colleagues talking about the radicalization of Islam or, you know, promoting Islamophobia or having four members of the other Republican Party who accused youngsters who are Muslims in our congressional offices as being subversive. You know, we have to be able to be aligned and ready to be able to respond to those kinds of things quickly and be able to broadly spread our responses, as we have done when the mayor of Roanoke had said something about the incarceration of Japanese Americans might be a good example of how we might want to deal with the refugees or those who are supposedly questionable in this country.
Which obviously struck home closely with you because you spent the early part of your life in a camp.
Sure.
Because your family was interred, put away.
Yeah. There's nothing like experience to be your teacher if you take the time to study and understand it. And there are a lot of Asian Americans, or Japanese Americans for that matter, who have not studied it and who are not connected to that experience, who may become subject to the whims of politicians who want to pull people down the wrong path. Japanese Americans in general, we should know better. We have that history. And it doesn't matter we're a fifth generation. We should be teaching our own community and our own offsprings our own history, and also tell them that our Japanese American history is an American history. And the histories and the lessons that we learned in terms of Constitution and the government, that should be applied to all people in this country. And that's, as a school teacher, that's what I've been trying to do as a member of Congress.
Well, but then when Congress is one party, majority party, carrying the presidency also, and you're in the minority party, how much sway can you have, in especially in very, very partisan times, which in your time in Congress, sure, it seemed to become more and more partisan. I mean, I don't know if you'd agree with that, but it seemed to be until we get to today, where it almost seems like Democrats and Republicans practically can't speak with each other looking from the outside.
Well, I think that's probably on the whole an accurate perception, in that Gingrich, when he was Speaker of the House, sent the edict out to his own members that thou shalt not interact with the other members of the other party, and if you do, you shall be punished. And over time, that became the practice. And I think that's unfortunate. But in spite of all that, I think that there are still folks out there that could be our soulmates. They're not all boogeymen. There are a lot of Republicans who are of good good character, good faith. They're just caught in a party that's extremely controlling. And I think that working with them and not seeing them as one monolithic character, but a collection of folks who have different backgrounds and experiences like we do, they just haven't gotten in touch with them, that we work with them and build this coalition even among the members of the Republican Party.
What do you think is going to happen then with this Congress under this president over the next 2 or 4 years?
Well, I suppose some people say we should wait and see, give him a chance. Well, I think we have to judge him on his behavior and what he's proposing, and be ready for, not to wait and see, but to be prepared for the worst. And take the words that he's used during the campaign and have our mindset around that and be prepared for that. And so that when something does occur, we're ready and we're able to organize. During the inauguration, quite a few people across the country had their massive marches and protests. I think that I would like to see that energy engaged on a daily basis, because what's the old saying? Democracy is not free, and it's not a spectator sport. And the price for that is being vigilant without being a vigilante. And I think that that's what's expected of us. Ultimately, we have to understand that the Constitution does require us to be active citizens and to challenge the government when they go awry. Because those of us who understand that when we took our oath not to the government, we took our oath to the Constitution. And that's a document that we have to hold up. And we have a lot of laws that were passed, but this doesn't mean it's legal. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's appropriate or moral or constitutional. It just means it's legal, and we have to fight it.
That's longtime Congressman Mike Honda, who represented California's 17th congressional district. Speaking of the Constitution, it's a thought that I've had recently, because obviously every politician, I think you can actually qualitatively say every politician talks about upholding the Constitution. It's just part of being in America as an elected official. The Constitution's a pretty old document, which has been amended in different ways, but it was a much different United States at that time when it was written. So it seems to me it's almost like spoken of reverentially, like biblically in a way, but with the Bible, there's fundamentalists and there's people who interpret it in different ways and recognize that some of the things that it says are in spirit more than in, to be taken literally. So what do you think of that concept regarding the Constitution? Like, how do you look at the Constitution?
Well, the Constitution is probably one of the older documents in terms of a democracy, but it has not been modified that many times compared to a lot of other constitutions in other countries. We've only had, 28, 29 amendments. And most of those amendments have been expansive, inclusive. And but the difference between the laws that we have on the books and the Constitution are two different arenas. And so what we haven't done is challenge the laws that are on the books to its constitutionality. And does it meet snuff? Right now, we have a situation politically in Washington, D.C., what they call the trifecta, you know, where one party is ruling and is control of the House, the Senate, and the White House with a Supreme Court that leans towards that party. So we're looking at a tsunami, and we have to be prepared for that and understand how to survive a tsunami. We can do it, but we have to be pretty well focused. And this is not the first time we've faced this kind of political situation.
Well, so do you think the Constitution should be held as gospel then, essentially?
Well, I think that we should know what we're talking about when we talk about the Constitution now. When we say due process, there'll be people who will try to mess with that concept and say it's judicial due process. But the purity of due process means that there's certain things that protect an individual, whether they're citizens or non-citizens in this country, and its purity, that's how we should be applying the Constitution. If that's not the way the Founding Fathers had thought of it, they would have said it a different way. But they were very clear in saying that all persons have the protection, enjoy the protection, and have the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The only distinction they make in terms of individuals in the Constitution, and I'm not a constitutional expert, I'm just a practitioner, so I could stand corrected, but the only distinction they make is between citizens and non-citizens who can run for office, federal office, and vote. And that's the only distinction they make. And over time, the framers of the Constitution, their mindset was one way when they said all men were created equal. They really meant all white men who are property. And today, we've been able to change the definition of what that means to be more inclusive. And that's what I meant by some of the amendments that we have. There's the one constitutional effort that has not reached its finality and it died, and that's the Equal Rights Amendment for Women. I think we were lacking three states to ratify it. But the framers also said and recognized that they were looking at an imperfect situation. So they said, in order to form a more perfect union, we hold these things, self-evident. And so we have to understand that. And it's like the good book, you know, you can take it literally. If you took it literally, then we have to understand also that it was written by inspiration of man. It wasn't written by the hand of the Almighty or of Allah or whatever deity that we want to espouse. But the concept of human rights and civil rights and universal human rights is not the first time it's embedded in our Constitution. It was first that I could understand. It's first written by Cyrus the Great when he said, universal human rights, and there was no distinction between a man and a woman in that fact.
Where was that and when?
Oh, it was pre-Islam. And I think that, and it came from that part of the world that we don't study enough.
That's Mike Honda. He represented California's 17th Congressional District for 16 years. So as somebody who has been in Washington, who was in Washington for a very long time, there's a lot of talk, which I need to ask you about, of the way that money influences politics. And I know that congresspeople, presidents, there's a lot of money around them all the time. And so how much influence do you think it ends up having on politics? There was a ethics inquiry, of course, into your involvement and something to do with that, too. So I'm just curious, because it's difficult as somebody from outside of Washington to see how these things work or why allegations are being made.
I think the clarification on the ethics charges that was filed against me was the violation is really around House rules. It's not about any laws that were passed locally or federally. It's about whether or not my staff had stepped over the line. And I think that's left up to interpretation. One was my chief of staff, on her own time and on her own email, had communicated with the campaign manager and said, let's make sure that we go through some of the other lists. And the list that she was talking about was the list that I have used to talk to some folks who are in the Bangladesh community. And it was her effort to make sure that we didn't have any stone unturned. But like Gmails and emails, and there's no inflection, there's no tone. So you can make it any way you want. And they charge us, you know, they're saying that we were operating on pay to play, which is nonsense. We had a State Department person who was a Bangladesh background. I wanted him to come down and present them to the community so that they can see that our government and our administration is utilizing folks from the diaspora. And so that became an issue. But when you don't have the media behind you, you know, it's pretty difficult to fight someone who buys ink by the barrel. So, but money influencing politics, I'm not sure that many people are really influenced by money. I think there's a lot of time, inordinate amount of time spent on raising money so you can run for office. But I'm not sure how many. I think the amount of people that sell themselves to lobbyists or anybody else, there's a handful, but I don't think that as a rule that you know, people do sell themselves. So I think that they consider folks, but I'm not sure that I would be comfortable saying that, you know, all politicians can be bought by lobbyists.
It seems like it would seem more likely for people who do get the ear of politicians to get more influence on bills that might pass or interest, just because those politicians and their staffers would end up getting more information on those.
Sure,
things.
And I think that that's probably accurate, that they could be more influential in influencing staffers and members if the staffers are not well schooled, if the members are not doing their research themselves. In my office, I call the lobbyists the third house. If they lie to me or misguide us, they're not welcome back, because I expect them to give us information. And I don't expect that we operate on the information they give us, but we take that into consideration and check it out. You know, as a science teacher, I always say to students, check it out. You know, and we try to make sure that critical thinking is part of our process in my office. And I've had quite a few PhDs and attorneys and folks who have gotten a lot of high degrees, but still we say, you know, you need to check it out.
So what's next for you then? Because it's been, over 4 decades of public service? Is that right, overall?
Yeah.
What's next for you?
Well, I think, number one, people need to understand that I only serve at their will. But it was a privilege to be able to do that. I tried to utilize the kinds of learnings and the lessons I've learned over my lifetime to return that back into the way I express myself and the way I do policies. I learned that my personal life could become policy and add to the perfection of creating policy by incorporating more people's lives into policy. So most people, if they really thought about it, they usually try to think of things and try to solve problems within the realm of their own experience. We have to bring in other people's experiences. And what does that mean now? There's a lot of unfinished work to be done. And one of them is my continued fight to have equity for each and every child in education. Not to drop the ball on my effort to have Asian American communities and certain African American folks be tested for hepatitis B and C, and also continue to fight what we call bullying that comes in all kinds of shapes, you know, targeting LGBT and right now the transgender population, and also those who are being targeted by folks who are afraid of folks who have different religions, and more specifically fight Islamophobia.
See, and I read you're just going fishing.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to have a little bit more time to do that. I'm just got to study the tide tables and the phases of the moon and put new fishing lines on my reel and tell my fishing pole I'm back.